Even yet it may be galvanized for a few moments into a ghastly burlesque of life if it happens to come within reach of a medium's, page 172, aura. Under such circumstances it will still exactly resemble its departed personality in appearance and may even reproduce to some extent his familiar expressions or handwriting. It is also the quality of being still blindly responsive to such vibrations, usually of the lowest order, as were frequently set up in it during its last stage of existence as a shade. 4. The vitalized shell. This entity is not, strictly speaking, human. Nevertheless, it is classified here because its outer vesture, the passive, senseless shell, was once an appanage of humanity. Such life, intelligence, desire, and will as it may possess are those of the artificial elemental, see page 45, animating it, this elemental being itself a creation of man's evil thought. A vitalized shell is always malevolent, it is a true tempting demon, whose evil influence is limited only by the extent of its power. Like the shade, it is frequently used in voodoo and Aba forms of magic. It is referred to by some writers as an elementary. 5. The suicide and victim of sudden death. These have already been described in chapter 15 on after-death life. It may be noted that this class, as well as shades and vitalized shells, are what may be called minor vampires, because when they have an opportunity they prolong their existence by draining away the vitality from human beings whom they are able to influence. 6. The vampire and werewolf. These two classes are today extremely rare. Examples are occasionally found, chiefly in countries where there is a considerable strain of fourth race blood, such as Russia or Hungary. It is just possible for a man to live such a degraded, selfish and brutal life that the whole of the lower mind becomes immersed in his desires and finally separates from the higher ego. This is possible only where every gleam of unselfishness or spirituality has been stifled, and where there is no redeeming feature whatever. Such a lost entity very soon after death finds himself unable to stay in the astral world, and is irresistibly, page 173, drawn in full consciousness into his own place, the mysterious eighth sphere, there slowly to disintegrate after experiences best left undescribed. If, however, he perishes by suicide or sudden death, he may under certain circumstances, especially if he knows something of black magic, hold himself back from that fate by the ghastly existence of a vampire. Since the eighth sphere cannot claim him until after the death of the body, he preserves it in a kind of cataleptic trance by transfusing into it blood drawn from other human beings by his semi-materialized astral body, thus postponing his final destiny by the commission of wholesale murder. The most effective remedy in such a case, as popular superstition rightly supposes, is to cremate the body, thus depriving the entity of his point d'appui. When the grave is opened, the body usually appears quite fresh and healthy, and the coffin is not unusually filled with blood. Cremation obviously makes this sort of vampirism impossible. The werewolf can first manifest only during a man's physical life, and it invariably implies some knowledge of magical arts, sufficient at any rate to enable him to project the astral body. When a perfectly cruel and brutal man does this, under certain circumstances the astral body may be seized upon by other astral entities and materialized, not into the human form, but into that of some wild animal, usually the wolf. In that condition it will range the surrounding country, killing other animals, and even human beings, thus satisfying not only its own craving for blood, but also that of the fiends who drive it on. In this case, as so often with ordinary materializations, a wound inflicted upon the astral form will be reproduced upon the human physical body by the curious phenomenon of repercussion, see page 242. But after the death of the physical body, the astral body, which will probably continue to appear in the same form, will be less vulnerable. Page 174. It will then, however, be also less dangerous, as unless it can find a suitable medium, it will be unable to materialize fully. in such manifestations. There is probably a great deal of the matter of the etheric double, and perhaps even some of liquid and gaseous constituents of the physical body, as in the case of some materializations. In both cases this fluidic body seems able to pass to much greater distances from the physical than is otherwise possible, so far as is known, for a vehicle containing etheric matter. The manifestations of both vampires and werewolves are usually restricted to the immediate neighborhood of their physical bodies. 7. The Black Magician and his pupil. This class corresponds, mutatis mutandis, to the pupil awaiting reincarnation, but in this case the man is defying the natural process of evolution by maintaining himself in astral life by magical arts, sometimes of the most horrible nature. It is considered undesirable to enumerate or describe the various subdivisions of this class, as an occult student wishes only to avoid them. All these entities, who prolong their life thus on the astral plane beyond its natural limit, do so at the expense of others and by the absorption of their life in some form or another. 8. The pupil awaiting reincarnation. This is also at present a rare class. A pupil who has decided not to take his devachan, that is, not to pass into the heaven world, but to continue to work on the physical plane, is sometimes, by permission only of a very high authority, allowed to do so, a suitable reincarnation being arranged for him by his master. Even when permission is granted, it is said that the pupil must confine himself strictly to the astral plane while the matter is being arranged, because if he touched the mental plane even for a moment he might be swept as by an irresistible current into the line of normal evolution again and so pass into the heaven world. Occasionally, though rarely, the pupil may be placed directly in an adult body whose previous tenant, page 175, has no further use for it, but it is seldom that a suitable body is available. Meanwhile the pupil is of course fully conscious on the astral plane and able to go on with the work given to him by his master, even more effectively than when hampered by a physical body. 9. The Nirmanakaya. It is very rarely indeed that a being so exalted as a Nirmanakaya manifests himself on the astral plane. A Nirmanakaya is one who, having won the right to untold ages of rest in bliss unspeakable, yet has chosen to remain within touch of earth, suspended as it were between this world and nirvana, in order to generate streams of spiritual force which may be employed for the helping of evolution. If he wished to appear on the astral plane he would probably create for himself a temporary astral body from the atomic matter of the plane. This is possible because a Nirmanakaya retains his causal body, and also the permanent atoms which he has carried all through his evolution, so that at any moment he can materialize around their mental, astral or physical bodies, if he so desires. Page 176, Chapter 20. Astral Entities, Non-Human. I Elemental Essence. The word elemental has been used by various writers to mean many different kinds of entities. It is here employed to denote, during certain stages of its existence, monadic essence, which in its turn may be denned as the outpouring of spirit or divine force into matter. It is most important that the student should realize that the evolution of this elemental essence is taking place on the downward curve of the arc, as it is often called, that is, it is progressing towards the complete entanglement in matter which we see in the mineral kingdom, instead of away from it. Consequently for it progress means descent into matter instead of ascent towards higher planes. Before the outpouring arrives at the stage of individualization at which it ensouls man, it has already passed through and ensouled six earlier phases of evolution, viz., the first elemental kingdom, on the higher mental plane, the second elemental kingdom, on the lower mental plane, the third elemental kingdom, on the astral plane, the mineral, vegetable and animal kingdoms. It has sometimes been called the animal, vegetable or mineral monad, though this is distinctly misleading, as long before it arrives at any of these kingdoms it has become not one but many monads. We are here dealing, of course, only with the astral elemental essence. This essence consists of the divine outpouring which has already veiled itself in matter down to the atomic level of the mental plane, and then plunged down directly into the astral plane, aggregating round itself a body of atomic astral matter, page 177. Such a combination is the elemental essence of the astral plane, belonging to the third elemental kingdom, the one immediately preceding the mineral. In the course of its 2401 differentiations on the astral plane, it draws to itself many and various combinations of the matter of the various subplanes. Nevertheless, these are only temporary, and it still remains essentially one kingdom. Strictly speaking, there is no such thing as an elemental in connection with the group we are considering. What we find is a vast store of elemental essence, wonderfully sensitive to the most fleeting human thought, responding with inconceivable delicacy, in an infinitesimal fraction of a second, to a vibration set up in it by an entirely unconscious exercise of human will or desire. But the moment that by the influence of such thought or will it is molded into a living force, it becomes an elemental, and belongs to the artificial class, to which we shall come in our next chapter. Even then its separate existence is usually evanescent, for as soon as its impulse has worked itself out, it sinks back into the undifferentiated mass of elemental essence from which it came. A visitor to the astral world will inevitably be impressed by the protean forms of the ceaseless tide of elemental essence, ever swirling around him, menacing often, yet always retiring before a determined effort of the will, and he will marvel at the enormous army of entities temporarily called out of this ocean into separate existence by the thoughts and feelings of man, whether good or evil. Broadly, the elemental essence may be classified according to the kind of matter it inhabits, that is, solid, liquid, gaseous, etc. These are the elementals of the medieval alchemists. They held, correctly, that an elemental, that is, a portion of the appropriate living elemental essence, inhered in each element, or constituent part, of every physical substance. Each of these seven main classes of elemental, page 178, essence may also be subdivided into seven subdivisions, making 49 subdivisions. In addition to, and quite separate from, these horizontal divisions, there are also seven perfectly distinct types of elemental essence, the difference between them having nothing to do with degree of materiality, but rather with character and affinities. The student will be familiar with this classification as the perpendicular one, having to do with the seven rays. There are also seven subdivisions in each ray type, making 49 perpendicular subdivisions. The total number of kinds of elemental essence is thus 49 by 49 or 2401. The perpendicular division is clearly far more permanent and fundamental than the horizontal division, for the elemental essence in the slow course of evolution passes through the various horizontal classes in succession, but remains in its own perpendicular subdivision all the way through. When any portion of the elemental essence remains for a few moments entirely unaffected by any outside influence, a condition hardly ever realized, it has no definite form of its own, but on the slightest disturbance it flashes into a bewildering confusion of restless, ever-changing shapes, which form, rush about, and disappear with the rapidity of the bubbles on the surface of boiling water. These evanescent shapes, though generally those of living creatures of some sort, human or otherwise, no more express the existence of separate entities in the essence than do the equally changeful and multiform waves raised in a few moments on a previously smooth lake by a sudden squall. They seem to be mere reflections from the vast storehouse of the astral light, yet they have usually a certain appropriateness to the character of the thought stream which calls them into existence, though nearly always with some grotesque distortion, some terrifying or unpleasant aspect about them. Page 179. When the elemental essence is thrown into shapes appropriate to the stream of half-conscious, involuntary thoughts which the majority of men allow to flow idly through their brains, The intelligence which selects the appropriate shape is clearly not derived from the mind of the thinker, neither can it derive from the elemental essence itself, for this belongs to a kingdom further from individualization even than a mineral, entirely devoid of awakened mental power. Nevertheless, the essence possesses a marvelous adaptability which often seems to come very near to intelligence. It is no doubt this property that caused elementals to be spoken of in early books as the semi-intelligent creatures of the astral light. The elemental kingdoms proper do not admit of such conceptions as good or evil. Nevertheless, there is a sort of bias or tendency permeating nearly all their subdivisions which renders them hostile rather than friendly towards man. Hence the usual experience of the neophyte on the astral plane, where vast hosts of protean specters advance threateningly upon him, but always retire or dissipate harmlessly when boldly faced. As stated by medieval writers, this bias or tendency is due entirely to man's own fault, and is caused by his indifference to, and want of sympathy with, other living beings. In the golden age of the past it was not so, any more than it will be so in the future when, owing to the changed attitude of man, both the elemental essence and also the animal kingdom will once again become docile and helpful to man instead of the reverse. It is thus clear that the elemental kingdom as a whole is very much what the collective thought of humanity makes it. There are many uses to which the forces inherent in the manifold varieties of the elemental essence can be put by one trained in their management. The vast majority of magical ceremonies depend almost entirely upon its manipulation, either directly by the will of the magician, or by some more definite astral entity evoked by him for the purpose. Page 180. By its means nearly all the physical phenomena of the seance room are produced, and it is also the agent in most cases of stone throwing or bell ringing in haunted houses, these latter being the results of blundering efforts to attract attention made by some earthbound human entity, or by the mere mischievous pranks of some of the minor nature spirits belonging to our third class, cp. 181. But the elemental must never be thought of as a prime mover, it is simply a latent force, which needs an external power to set it in motion. 2. The astral bodies of animals. This is an extremely large class, yet it does not occupy a particularly important position on the astral plane, since its members usually stay there but a very short time. The vast majority of animals have not as yet permanently individualized, and when one of them dies, the monadic essence which has been manifesting through it flows back again into the group soul whence it came, bearing with it such advancement or experience as has been attained during earth life. It is not, however, able to do this immediately. The astral body of the animal rearranges itself just as in man's case, and the animal has a real existence on the astral plane, the length of which, though never great, varies according to the intelligence which it has developed. In most cases it does not seem to be more than dreamily conscious, but appears perfectly happy. The comparatively few domestic animals who have already attained individuality, and will therefore be reborn no more as animals in this world, have a much longer and more vivid life on the astral plane than their less advanced fellows. Such an individualized animal usually remains near his earthly home and in close touch with his especial friend and protector. This period will be followed by a still happier period of what has been called dozing consciousness, which will last until in some future world the human form is assumed. During all that time he is in a condition analogous to that of a human, page 181, being in the heaven world, though at a somewhat lower level. One interesting subdivision of this class consists of the astral bodies of those anthropoid apes mentioned in The Secret Doctrine, Volume I, p. 184, who are already individualized, and will be ready to take human incarnation in the next round, or perhaps some of them even sooner. In civilized countries, these animal astral bodies add much to the general feeling of hostility on the astral plane. For the organized butchery of animals in slaughterhouses and for sport sends millions into the astral world, full of horror, terror and shrinking from man. Of late years these feelings have been much intensified by the practice of vivisection. 3. Nature spirits of all kinds. This class is so large and so varied that it is possible here to give only some idea of the characteristics common to all of them. The nature spirits belong to an evolution quite distinct from our own. They neither have been nor ever will be members of a humanity such as ours. Their only connection with us is that we temporarily occupy the same planet. They appear to correspond to the animals of a higher evolution. They are divided into 7 great classes, inhabiting the same 7 states of matter permeated by the corresponding varieties of elemental essence. Thus, there are nature spirits of the earth, water, air, fire, or ether, definite, intelligent astral entities residing and functioning in each of those media. Only the members of the air class normally reside in the astral world, but their numbers are so prodigious that they are everywhere present in it. In medieval literature, earth spirits are often called gnomes, water spirits undines, air spirits sylphs, and ether spirits salamanders. In popular language, they have been variously called fairies, pixies, elves, brownies, fairies, djinns, trolls, satyrs, fauns, kobolds, imps, goblins, good people, etc. Their forms are many and various, but most, page 182, frequently human in shape and somewhat diminutive in size. Like almost all astral entities, they are able to assume any appearance at will, though they undoubtedly have favorite forms which they wear when they have no special object in taking any other. Usually they are invisible to physical sight, but they have the power of making themselves visible by materialization when they wish to be seen. At the head of each of these classes is a great being, the directing and guiding intelligence of the whole department of nature, which is administered and energized by the class of entities under his control. These are known by the Hindus as 1. Indra, Lord of the Akasha, or Ether; 2. Agni, Lord of Fire; 3. Pavana, Lord of Air; 4. Varuna, Lord of Water; 5. Kshiti, Lord of Earth. The vast kingdom of nature spirits, as stated above, is in the main an astral kingdom, though a large section of it appertains to the etheric levels of the physical plane. There is an immense number of subdivisions or races among them, individuals varying in intelligence and disposition just as human beings do. Most of them avoid man altogether, his habits and emanations are distasteful to them, and the constant rush of astral currents set up by his restless, unregulated desires disturbs and annoys them. Occasionally, however, they will make friends with human beings and even help them. The helpful attitude is rare. In most cases they exhibit either indifference or dislike, or take an impish delight in deceiving and tricking men. Many instances of this may be found in lonely mountainous districts and in the seance room. They are greatly assisted in their tricks by the wonderful power of glamour they possess, so that their victims see and hear only what these fairies impress upon them, exactly as with mesmerized subjects. The nature spirits, however, cannot dominate the human will, except in the case of very weak-minded people, or of those who allow terror to paralyze, page 183, their will. They can deceive the senses only, and they have been known to cast their glamour over a considerable number of people at the same time. Some of the most wonderful feats of Indian jugglers are performed by invoking their aid in producing collective hallucination. They seem usually to have little sense of responsibility, and the will is generally less developed than in the average man. They can, therefore, readily be dominated mesmerically and employed to carry out the will of the magician. They may be utilized for many purposes, and will carry out tasks within their power faithfully and surely. They are also responsible, in certain mountainous regions, for throwing a glamour over a belated traveler, so that he sees, for example, houses and people where he knows none really exist. These delusions are frequently not merely momentary, but may be maintained for quite a considerable time. the man going through quite a long series of imaginary but striking adventures and then suddenly finding that all his brilliant surroundings have vanished, and that he is left standing in a lonely valley or on a windswept plain. The feelings which burn steadily and without wild surgings create an atmosphere in which nature spirits delight to bathe. Almost all nature spirits delight also in music. They may even enter a house in order to enjoy it, bathing in the sound waves, pulsating and swaying in harmony with them. To nature spirits must also be attributed a large portion of what are called physical phenomena at spiritualistic seances. Indeed, many a seance has been, page 184, given entirely by these mischievous creatures. They are capable of answering questions, delivering pretended messages by raps or tilts, exhibiting spirit lights, the apport of objects from a distance, the reading of thoughts in the mind of any person present, the precipitation of writing or drawings, and even materializations. They could, of course, also employ their power of glamour to supplement their other tricks. They may not in the least mean to harm or deceive, but naively rejoice in their success in playing their part, and in the awe-stricken devotion and affection lavished upon them as dear spirits and angel helpers. They share the delight of the sitters and feel themselves to be doing a good work in thus comforting the afflicted. They will also sometimes masquerade in thought forms that men have made, and think it a great joke to flourish horns, to lash a forked tail, and to breathe out flame as they rush about. Occasionally an impressionable child may be terrified by such appearances, but in fairness to the nature spirit it must be remembered that he himself is incapable of fear and so does not understand the gravity of the result, probably thinking that the child's terror is simulated and a part of the game. None of the nature spirits possess a permanent reincarnating individuality. It seems, therefore, that in their evolution a much greater proportion of intelligence is developed before individualization takes place. The life periods of the various classes vary greatly, some being quite short, others much longer than our human lifetime. Their existence on the whole appears to be simple, joyous, irresponsible, such as a party of happy children might lead among exceptionally favorable physical surroundings. There is no sex among nature spirits, there is no disease, and there is no struggle for existence. They have keen affections and can form close and lasting friendships. Jealousy and anger are possible to them, but seem quickly to fade away before the overwhelming, page 185, delight in all the operations of nature which is their most prominent characteristic. Their bodies have no internal structure, so that they cannot be torn asunder or injured, neither has heat or cold any effect upon them. They appear to be entirely free from fear. Though tricky and mischievous, they are rarely malicious, unless definitely provoked. As a body they distrust man, and generally resent the appearance of a newcomer on the astral plane, so that he usually meets them in an unpleasant or terrifying form. If, however, he declines to be frightened by them, they soon accept him as a necessary evil and take no further notice of him, while some may even become friendly. One of their keenest delights is to play with and to entertain in 100 different ways children on the astral plane who are what we call dead. Some of the less childlike and more dignified have sometimes been reverenced as wood gods or local village gods. These would appreciate the flattery paid them, and would no doubt be willing to do any small service they could in return. The adept knows how to use the services of the nature spirits, and frequently entrusts them with pieces of work, but the ordinary magician can do so only by invocation, that is, by attracting their attention as a suppliant and making some kind of a bargain with them, or by evocation, that is, by compelling their obedience. Both methods are extremely undesirable. Evocation is also exceedingly dangerous, as the operator would arouse a hostility which might prove fatal to him. No pupil of a master would ever be permitted to attempt anything of the kind. The highest type of nature spirits consists of the sylphs or the spirits of the air, which have the astral body as their lowest vehicle. They have intelligence equal to that of the average man. The normal method for them to attain to individualization is to associate with and love the members of the next stage above them, the astral angels. Page 186. A nature spirit who desires the experience of human life may obsess a person living in the physical world.